Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Some new recruits to Alberta, funded by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, promised to make great strides in the way we treat certain medical conditions. Dr. Simonetta Scipioni is researching a link between cholesterol and Huntington's disease. Dr. Yves Sauvé is looking at the impact of certain omega-3 fatty acids on age-related macular degeneration. And cardiologist Dr. Lori West is furthering her research that made it possible for newborns to receive transplanted hearts from mismatched donors. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Once called St. Vitus's Dance, Huntington's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder. People afflicted with Huntington's eventually lose their motor skills and exhibit jerky, uncontrollable movements. While genetic in nature, there may be a link between Huntington's and cholesterol. Pharmacologist Dr. Simonetta Scipioni is part of a group in Milan that made this discovery. She's now an Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research scholar at the University of Alberta.
Huntington's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder, and it is an inherited disease. That means that it can be transmitted from parents to children, and the children with affected parents have 50% chances to inherit the disease. Usually, the first symptoms of the disease appear when patients are in their 30s or 40s. But there are more severe forms of the disease where actually the disease can start in childhood, during childhood. Unfortunately, what this disease does is to impair motor function of the patients. They cannot control their movements anymore, especially movements of the upper part of the body. The disease is called also chorea. Chorea is a word that comes from the Greek word for dance, and this is because actually patients move almost like if they were dancing, but these movements are not controllable. They are totally out of control. And if you think about it, not being able to control the movements of your body will actually affect very seriously your life, because at later stages of the disease, the HD patients cannot actually even stand still on a chair because they would fall from the chair. They cannot do almost, they cannot conduct a normal life. And motor problems are not the only problems in Huntington's disease. There are also psychiatric problems that are associated with the disease, depression, occasionally schizophrenia. And there is a gradual, progressive decline of cognitive functions. The disease actually can last for 10, 25 years. Eventually, the patient will die, will first become completely dependent from caregivers for any basic life function. And eventually, they will die after a long sufferance.
Is there any treatment at this time?
Unfortunately, no. There is no cure for Huntington's disease. There are drugs that are prescribed to try to contain specific symptoms of the disease, in some cases depression or schizophrenia, but there is no cure for the disease.
What is it that you're trying to achieve in your lab here?
Well, we are trying to understand why the cells of the brain in Huntington disease patients become dysfunctional and eventually die. We are trying to understand different dysfunctions in these cells. For example, we are trying to understand why communication among cells in the brain of HD patients fails, why the neurons slowly and progressively die.
Well, you've made some sort of a discovery about cholesterol and its relationship to Huntington's. What's that?
Well, this is a relatively new area in the field. A few years ago, we discovered together with a group in Milan, the group of Dr. Elena Cattaneo, we discovered that in cells and in brains of HD animal models, and also in cells from Huntington disease patients, the production of cholesterol is impaired. Now, we believe that this may have a profound impact in the development of the disease. And this is because cholesterol is an essential molecule for the brain. It has many functions in the brain. Without cholesterol, we would not be able to live. Now, what is interesting is that the pool of cholesterol in the brain is completely independent from the pool of cholesterol in the rest of the body. And while the rest of the body is able to also get cholesterol, not only to produce cholesterol, but also to get cholesterol from the diet, the brain cannot get cholesterol from the diet. So it only depends on its own production of cholesterol. Now, perhaps this is the reason why every single mutation affecting proteins that are involved either in the production of cholesterol or in the transport of cholesterol result in a neurological or in a neurodegenerative disease. Now, until a few years ago, as I said before, we didn't know that the production of cholesterol could be impaired also in Huntington disease. There was no link known between the disease and cholesterol. But now we believe that there is a lipid connection also in Huntington disease.
What might that be?
Because of reduced production, not only of cholesterol, but also other special lipids in the brain of HD patients, communication among the cells may be dysfunctional, and many other cell functions that are directly dependent on the amount of cholesterol that is available will actually be affected. So impairment of the production of lipids may be a very important and relatively early event in the development of the disease.
Well, now that you're looking in that area, what have you discovered recently? Or do you have any indication of how this is actually working?
A first indication that we are collecting these days is that the lack of specific type of lipids affect directly the communication among cells in the brain of HD animal models, and we believe this is going to happen also in the brain of patients. So right now we are specifically looking at how cells in the brain of HD, in Huntington disease brains, communicate with each other, and how we can restore normal communication by modulating the amount of these special lipids and cholesterol that are important for cell-to-cell communication.
Where might this lead? Would this be like the magic bullet that would cure Huntington's?
I'm not sure whether this can be the magic bullet. I believe that this is an important aspect in the disease that we need to understand and to address. Huntington disease is due to multiple dysfunctions. I think that the likeliest scenario is that we will need to develop multiple drugs that target multiple pathways affected in the disease. And one of these drugs could be a drug, for example, that help production of lipids in Huntington disease brains. But this is not going to be the only magic bullet. I believe that eventually the cure for the disease will come not from one single drug, but from a cocktail of drugs addressing many problems at the same time.
You're looking at this in relation to Huntington's, but do you see this cholesterol link having applications to other diseases?
Actually, this has already been known for quite a while. For example, cholesterol and cholesterol metabolisms seems to be involved in Alzheimer's disease. There are many studies now in the Alzheimer's disease field trying to understand the connection between cholesterol metabolism and the development of the disease. It's interesting, for example, that in the case of Alzheimer's disease, the only drug that seems to prevent somehow the development of Alzheimer's disease are statins, which are molecules, which are drugs that affect and reduce production of cholesterol. Yes, definitely cholesterol may be and the dysfunction of cholesterol metabolism may be involved in many neurological and neurodegenerative disorders.
Thank you very much, Simonetta.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Dr. Simonetta Scipioni, an assistant professor of pharmacology at the University of Alberta. She's also an Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research scholar. Age-related macular degeneration is one of the major causes of blindness in seniors. About one quarter of all people over 75 will develop this vision problem. That's why prevention is the key for Dr. Yves Sauvé, an assistant professor of ophthalmology and physiology at the University of Alberta. Yves is researching a link between a decline in omega-3 fatty acids and the onset of macular degeneration.
But basically, it's a disease that affects the region of the eye that we need for high-definition vision, which is called the macula, hence the name macular in the term. So age, of course, because it is higher propensity as you get older. So, in fact, it is the main cause of blindness in the aged in the Western world.
How serious a problem is that?
Well, the problem is that the baby boomers are getting older, and in 2011, we were just increasing to 14% compared with 10% in 2004. And in 2026, we're going to be up to 20% of people over 65. And that is a serious problem. It's not that we have more incidence of AMD itself, but it's that more people are getting old. So it is a serious problem, and we need to catch it early. Prevention would be the solution rather than reversing that disease. We can talk about it later if you want.
What is it that you're doing with your research on this?
We're trying to understand the mechanism, and we're also exploring a preventive treatment rather than a reversible reconstructing the eye, if you wish. So our prevention is based on nutrition because it's applicable non-discriminately around the world. It's a food, so it's an omega-3, basically. And try to sensitize people on the benefits of omega-3. Omega-3 are a very diverse group of fatty acid, and the one we're interested in at the moment is DHA. You might have seen it on the shelves in products, in the milk, the yogurt, the cheese, whatever. I think I've seen it in mayonnaise as well. But DHA stands for docosahexaenoic acid. But let's keep talking about it as DHA. And that has 50% of the fatty acid, so the fat, in our photoreceptor. This is the cells that we need to see, the cones and the rods. Remember the cones for day vision, the rods for night vision? 50% of the fat, because they're really fatty, okay, is DHA.
How does that affect the eyes then? Are we losing that, or do we need more of it?
Well, with age, we do lose it. We do. It is a fact of life that the concentration of DHA in the eye does go down with age. I'm not a specialist of the whole human body, but DHA has been associated with other conditions that we don't need to go over now. But what we're trying to do is to maintain a level and perhaps increase a certain level of DHA. And how we can test that at the moment is using a mouse model.
Tell me about your mouse model.
Well, let me tell you about the problem of the mouse is that we talked about AMD, and the M, the middle letter, is macula. And a mouse does not have a macula, but it has the advantage of manipulating genes. So what we've done is we use a mutation that causes symptoms that are analogous to AMD. We're not going to say that the mouse is properly an AMD model because it doesn't have macula, but it has features. And one of the features I want to talk about is bad fat called lipofuscin and A2E. These are bad fats, and they accumulate behind the eye, and it's called dry AMD. This is the first set of AMD. So AMD can be divided into dry and wet. So we start with dry, and when you have dry AMD, you have these fat deposits that you can see with a fundus camera. So AHFMR provided us with a fantastic high-definition camera that allows us to see very, very fine details about these deposits, which are bad news. This is the major risk factor for developing wet AMD. And wet AMD is when you become blind because blood accumulates and it destroys the macula, that region. And the great thing about our mouse is it has the dry form. So we're able with our omega-3 to feed the mouse and see are we or not reducing the bad fat accumulation. And why is it doing it? Nobody knows why the bad fat is accumulating. So we're trying to understand the mechanism.
So what you're saying then is you develop this condition where you have the bad fat, but the omega-3 would be the good fat.
Yes.
And so if you can get more of the good fat or the omega-3 in there, you might actually be able to do something about this.
That is the very simplistic way of explaining it. And the complex way is how DHA acts. And there are many schools of thoughts. One is to keep it in the photoreceptors. And another is that itself is like a savior of the cells. It's like a protectant of the cells. So we're exploring both avenues by measuring the content in collaboration with Dr. Tom Clandenin in nutrition here at U of A, who's a specialist on DHA and its benefits. So we're just feeding our mice, and in addition to looking at the good and the bad fat, we're also looking at the changes in the eyes of these mice, both with the anatomy, so the fantastic camera, but also electrically, because you know the eye uses electricity when it responds to light, and we can actually measure it. So again, AHFMR gave us this amazing equipment that is so sensitive that we can measure these changes. When we flash light in front of our mouse, we can measure changes of electricity. And the great news is, well, we can see it go down as the mouse ages. That's the mouse with the mutation. That's our model. And then the good news is, let me just tell you, the good news is that we fed these mice and we found that we could preserve that electrical current to a better value so it doesn't go down as fast. So we see a benefit of feeding our mice. Now we're trying to understand why is it doing it? Why is it good?
Is this going to lead to a test where you can tell early on if someone is going to develop age-related macular degeneration?
This is a research that we do in parallel because as we follow our mice that are fed and not fed with age, we can do that test because the test is non-invasive. So we repeat the test in the same mouse as it ages. We can see changes, subtle changes, and we develop tests with that machine, that equipment called the electroretinogram that was purchased with AHFMR's money. And that these tests were developing new tests that don't exist in the clinic. And the great thing is that equipment is the same that we use for humans. Of course, we clean it up with alcohol, but we are developing, as we speak, tests in the aged. So we have volunteers coming in our lab and submitting themselves to that recording and see, as they age, how that electrical function changes. And, of course, the next step is to take people that will develop AMD. We will follow them. We will ask them to come back and pick up the early onset. And we have a working hypothesis.
The omega-3 fatty acids that you're dealing with,
yeah,
are they something that are naturally available in our foods? And which ones?
Well, oily fish would be definitely a great source. But then you have the debate of a big fish being a predator of smaller fish and accumulating more mercury. So we have to play with that. It's very important. Anchovies will contain it as well. So I think it's important to take an oily fish that wouldn't be too big so it doesn't have too much mercury. Kale has some omega-3s. Now we have precursors of omega-3s, like flaxseed oil. That is a wonderful precursor. Unfortunately, if you eat McDonald's the same day, it won't be converted in DHA. So flaxseed oil is a fantastic precursor of DHA. I'm just repeating myself. But the bad fat, the McDonald's fats, and I'm not saying McDonald's is bad. I'm just giving this as an example of saturated fat, will compete and prevent us from making it. So we're not good at making it. We can use flaxseed, but we must not use the saturated fat the same day.
What's next for you then in this research?
What's next is to now take our mice that have been fed DHA and that are improving electrically, the response is improving, is understand the mechanism. So we go with the anatomy, the biochemistry. What is the mechanism? Why is DHA working? Why? This is the next step, the mechanism. And, of course, once we are happy with the mechanism and we see that there is no side effects, then we would like a large-scale DHA study. But as I say, there is something going on in the States right now, but it does not address the mechanism per se.
Thank you very much, Eve.
You're very welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Eve Sauvé, an assistant professor in ophthalmology and physiology at the University of Alberta. He's also a senior scholar supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Rejection is one of the major concerns when an organ is transplanted from one person to another. However, the situation appears to be much different for babies. Dr. Lori West is known around the world for her discovery. The infant immune system is different from that of adults, and she has shown that babies can receive transplanted hearts from donors with incompatible blood types. Lori is now director of the Cardiac Transplantation Research Program at the University of Alberta, and she's a senior scholar funded by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research.
Well, originally I trained as a pediatric cardiologist, and there were, at the time, in the mid-90s, there were particular populations of patients, early 90s I should say, particular populations of patients for whom there were really no clinical options, children who were born with malformed hearts who were doomed to die because there were just no options that worked for them. And that was a very compelling patient population to work with. And so I became interested in transplantation as a potential therapy that one could offer to newborn babies. And I headed off to England to do my research training in the immunology of transplantation. And while I was doing that training, the model I worked with was concerned with the very young developing immune system. In our case, we used mice to carry out experiments looking at how the very young immune system could be altered so that it would accept a transplant much more easily than the adult system could be altered that way. And this is called tolerance, and this is really what set us on the road to thinking about applying some of those same principles to very young human patients who needed heart transplants.
Well, how do you go about altering an immune system?
Well, that's an interesting question. One can alter an immune system in early in life because it's very susceptible to being re-educated, if you like. The very young immune system is still learning what's self and what's foreign. And so through certain manipulations, such as the injection of cells from an animal that would be the eventual donor of an organ, one could change the development, the education of the recipient immune system such that it would not perceive that as foreign, but would recognize it as self. Therefore, it wouldn't reject an organ later on that came from the same source. And that model is a model that's been used for 50 years now called neonatal tolerance. And that, although the principles are a little bit different than what we eventually came to do in heart transplants, that nonetheless, the principles led us to understand that certain things might be possible in human infants as well.
So how does it actually work then with human infants when you're making these transplants?
Well, in the human setting, of course, we don't have the opportunity to treat the baby ahead of the transplant. And so this work became applicable to the human infant in a slightly different way. What we did know was that, number one, we had a very high mortality rate for children who were waiting for heart transplants because there weren't enough organs to go around. And that, combined with an understanding of the immaturity of the immune system of very young infants, caused us to reevaluate the need for matching of blood types between donors and recipients. And in doing so, we became convinced that the infant's immune system was sufficiently immature that it would not mount the very, very aggressive kind of rejection called hyperacute rejection that one would normally find in older individuals if you transplanted an organ between a donor and recipient of mismatched blood types.
Does that carry on for a lifetime then? If the transplant comes early enough, then is it okay for the rest of their life?
Well, of course, we don't know that yet because the first children, there now have been close to 100 children built on our original report of 10. There have now been about 100 children worldwide who've received blood group mismatched transplants. And in this population as a whole, of course, it's still a small population, and the oldest child is now 12 years old, having been transplanted as a newborn. So far, we don't see any complication related to the blood group incompatibility between donor and recipient. I mean, the children still are transplant patients. In other words, they have other mechanisms of mounting an immune response against all the other things that are foreign in their donor heart, other than the blood group. So we have to take those into consideration when looking at their overall health as transplant patients. But as far as the discovery that we made about mismatched blood types, that seems so far to be throughout the life of the patient, we haven't seen that foreign blood type elicits an immune response.
Can this be applied to other organs?
Theoretically, it can. There are different reasons why, for example, kidney transplants aren't generally done in very, very young infants in the newborn period. It may be that by the time a kidney transplant would be done, the immune system would already have matured beyond the stage of the window, if you like, of opportunity for this procedure to be done this way. Liver transplantation, although carried out in very young infants, generally is a more easily accepted organ across a blood group anyway. And so we think that, yes, it's probably likely that the same principles apply in liver transplantation as in heart transplantation.
With this knowledge, is there any chance that this could be applied to the adult population?
That's a key question. A key question is whether we would be able to take the strategies and the knowledge that we've evolved in the young immune system and apply those same principles to adults, who, of course, represent much bigger numbers of patients in need of transplants. There is similar work being done in adults who receive kidney transplants, but it's more along the lines of removing the barriers rather than removing the antibodies that are already developed in humans rather than fundamentally altering the production of the antibodies. What we hope is that as we study these infants as they grow up who've received mismatched heart transplants, that we will be able to understand the mechanisms whereby the immune system has become so fundamentally altered. And in that way, if we understand those mechanisms, we may be able to develop sensible strategies that may be reasonable to think about applying to adults.
What is the big research question for you now?
Well, the big research questions really, they have to do with B cells and how B cells are the cells in our body's immune system that produce antibodies. And B cells have become a very important target in transplantation in recent years. And we need to know, and we're exploring much more fundamental aspects of B cell biology so that we can understand more completely and more clearly how we can potentially come to change what would be the natural course of events for a B cell.
Thank you very much, Lori.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Lori West, a professor of pediatrics, surgery, and immunology at the University of Alberta. She's the director of the Cardiac Transplantation Research Program there, as well as a staff cardiologist at the Stollery Children's Hospital. And she's a senior scholar supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.